It was Jesus who said that it is through much tribulation that we enter the kingdom. The way to a throne is never easy. And it is through tribulation that God's men enter their kingdoms and their destinies. Now we are thinking tonight of how David came to his kingdom by the capture of Jebus. And I want to say, first of all, before we look at the actual story of the capture of this little village, so significant it is, you see, for Christians as well as for Jews, Jerusalem, that's what it became. I want to say that spiritual leadership is never an easy business. And David has gone through many, many struggles and difficulties before he enters his kingdom. It has cost David to enter his kingdom, and it has also cost God to bring David to the kingdom. Now let's just think about that. What did it cost David to come to his kingdom? Well, you see, the trouble with David was this, that his kingdom was really begun in blood. And it was continued in blood. You read the stories of the intrigues and the murders, and in fact his kingdom was ended in blood, because in fact blood was the last word that David spoke lying on his deathbed. That was his last message to the world, the word blood. And it was because David was a violent man and a man given to blood that David was denied by God the honor of building a house for God, the temple. This is why the temple of God in Jerusalem was built not by David, but by David's son, because David's son was Solomon, and the name Solomon means peace. It's the same as salam or shalom. David was a man of war. Solomon was a man of peace. And to Solomon went the privilege of building God's house, because God was not prepared to allow a murderer to build his house in Jerusalem, the home for his glory. And that's, you see, what it cost David to enter his kingdom. He's come to his kingdom, he has captured Jerusalem, he's now on his throne over all the tribes of Israel. Formerly he just was king of one tribe, and the 11 were against him. Now he's king of them all. But it has cost him. And it has also cost God to bring David to the kingdom. Because, you see, one of the principles in God's kingdom is this, that people who are not prepared to move with God have to be removed. They're set aside. And at great cost, God has had to put aside two men who were rivals to David's kingdom and David's throne. The first of these was Ish-bosheth, king, son of Saul. And the second of these was Abner, who was the captain of Saul's army. You see, the madness of these two men was this, that they knew that God was with David. They saw that God was behind this man. They saw that God was behind this new kingdom and this new work and this new venture. And in spite of the fact that they saw that God was with this man, they deliberately set up a rival kingdom to challenge the kingdom of David. And this is why, you see, Ish-bosheth, the weakling, the puppet king, this non-entity who challenged God's man and God's work and God's kingdom. This is why Ishbosheth eventually had to be removed. He was removed by murder, if you remember the story. And this was why, too, you see, Abner, who was a chancer, he was the spiritual opportunist. He wanted to cash in on the work of God. He wanted to grab what was going while the going was good. And this was why Abner, too, had to be removed. Because it is a principle, you see, in God's kingdom, that when God is marching on, the people who do not march on with him are left behind. Are you marching with God tonight? Or are you one of the spectators I was speaking about this morning? The churches are full of spectators, as if the church of God was a theater, as if preaching was a performance, as if a congregation was an audience, as if public worship was a spectacle, as if the mighty works of God were performed by God for our entertainment and our amusement. But you see, when God is on the move, and when God is marching in a church, and when God is marching in the life of a congregation, you are not allowed to be a spectator. Those who do not march with God, sooner or later, are left behind. And so Ishbosheth and Abner, with their rival kingdom challenging the kingdom and the throne of David, are simply set aside. And David goes marching on. Now the wonderful thing is this. Get this message, if you get nothing else. The tribes came to him because he had a magnetic personality. Now, can you baptize that into Christian terms? There is a magnetism about Jesus Christ that brings men to him. Jesus said, I will draw all men unto myself. Jesus Christ is a very fascinating character. He attracts men. He draws people. That's why he should be preached more often in the churches. Jesus Christ who draws and attracts men. And these tribes, the 12 tribes, the 11 who were against him, came effortlessly to David and laid their gifts in homage at his feet. There was no effort. There was no calculation. David didn't need an evangelistic campaign. He simply was himself. And because God was in him and working through him, people rallied. Now get that message. It's the power of authentic Christian character that draws people and attracts people. You don't need to calculate it. You don't need to titivate character. You don't need to doctor Jesus Christ in order to make him attractive. Christian character is the thing that draws people to the work of God and to the gospel. Christian character. And if you don't have that, well, you've missed the whole point of the preaching of the gospel. It's either there and attracting people to Jesus Christ, or it's not there. Samuel Chadwick, the great Methodist preacher, used to say, when there's a fire in a village, you don't need to tell anybody. The word soon gets around if there's a fire. You see, fire gathers a crowd. Suppose you've noticed that. When there's a fire on, people come to see the spectacle. You see, the fire, if it is its own advertisement. And it's like that with David, because he is on fire for God. And the warmth of the fire and the brightness of the fire of God in David is something that has attracted men to him and built up his kingdom. The fire is its own attraction, and it's the fire that makes a man an evangelist. I'm speaking about Christian character now. I'm not speaking about techniques. I think there are too many techniques nowadays in evangelism. Too many gimmicks. Too many slick phrases. Too much methodology. And not enough Christian character. If you want to do something for Jesus Christ, then capture the fire. And that's what David did. And it was its own advertisement. And it drew the 12 tribes to him, and the kingdom of God grew. That's the first point. Fire is a great evangelist. Are you a cold Christian? Are you one of these detached Christians? Non-committal. Do people know where you stand? What you stand for? Are you not ashamed to hoist the flag? I tell you, a cold Christian is an abomination to God. God is a warm-hearted God. God is a great heart. His heart is fire. The Bible says so. Our God is a consuming fire. Cold Christians with icicle hearts and icicle spines. That's the first point. Catch the fire. That's the great evangelist. Thinking about the fire of character. The second great lesson is this. It's possible for men to miss their destiny for years. Now that little town of Jebus crops up again and again and again throughout the Old Testament, and some of the greatest men of God have bypassed it, and they haven't realized that that place was their destiny. You see, when God called Abraham from Ur of the Chaldees, one of the things he did was this. He promised him a city. That's how Hebrews 11 puts it. He looked for a city that has foundations, whose maker and builder is God. Now, of course, it was the heavenly Jerusalem that Abraham was promised, but the earthly Jerusalem was a kind of prelude to that. The earthly Jerusalem was a kind of mirror and a preparation for the heavenly Jerusalem. And Abraham, in his journey, several times came near the village of Jebus and didn't realize that his destiny was there. He traveled south through the land on his way to Egypt, and he bypassed Jebus, Jerusalem, and he didn't go in, landing in Egypt, trouble with Pharaoh, up through the land, and then he met Melchizedek, who was the priest of Jerusalem in those days. It's a great story, and Abraham never saw that his destiny lay there. Let's read about it. First of all, in Genesis, chapter 14. What was the town called before it was called Jebus? It was called Salem. See, it had three names. Originally, it was Salem, and it had a king all of its own, the man called Melchizedek, a strange figure, rather like Merlin coming out of the mists of the past, a strange, weird person, Melchizedek, the priest king of Salem. Genesis chapter 14. And Abraham has just rescued his nephew Lot. After his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the Vale of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, what's he doing there? Well, this was before the place was called Jebus. I think that that little place, Salem, with its priest king Melchizedek, was a kind of outpost for God in the paganism of that ancient world. He's a strange character. Hebrews in the New Testament tells us that he was a kind of Christ. A strange character. I think that that little place was the light of God shining in the darkness of the heathendom amongst the Amalekites and the Canaanites and all these other godless tribes. I think it was a place that lost its light, and that's why the Jebusites got it, you see. And it became a heathen citadel, just as Scotland has lost its light. Think of the impact that Scotland has had on the world, far beyond its size, out of proportion to its size. Go to Canada, Mackenzie Rivers all over the place, Aberdeens and Hamiltons and so on, all over the world. Because we made an impact, you see, in those days. But we've lost that light now, when we've lost the impetus. Now I think Salem, under the godly Melchizedek, this strange person, I think that was the light of God shining in the darkness, and somehow it lost its light, just as churches can lose the light and villages can lose the light. And it moved into the darkness of Jebusite heathendom before David captured it. Now, if you've an alternative theory, I'll be glad to hear it. Genesis chapter 14 and verse 18. And Melchizedek, the king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. You see, he's a Christ-like person. Bread and wine, like communion. Bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, right in the middle of that heathen country, right out of the blue. Wonderful. And he blessed him and said, he blessed Abraham. He's a priest, you see. Blessed be Abraham by God Most High, maker of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And Abraham gave Melchizedek a tenth of everything. So that's what was there in Jebus. before David came. If you turn to Hebrews, you'll find the same story. Hebrews chapter 7. What I'm trying to show you is this, in case you don't know. Abraham came near his destiny there, you see, because I think God was saying to Abraham, go on, man, make friends with the fellow. The gates opened and out came Melchizedek. I think God was saying to Abraham, go on, man, shake hands with him and be friendly with him, because that man's a kind of Christ. He's a kind of Messiah, the Messiah who's going to come out of your loins. You are the prelude to this Messiah. Now go on and make friends with that chap in Salem. And Abraham missed the boat. He sailed away, moved away from Jerusalem. You see, he missed his destiny. It takes some men a long time to reach their destiny. You know, I used to spend holidays in Inverness while this church was vacant. And I used to go bed and breakfast at a house round in Mid Mills Road, just round the corner from the manse. And I suppose I must have passed the manse umpteen times and looked at the weeds lying empty for 3 years. You see? You brush past your destiny. You don't know when the hour has struck. How was I to know? You see that my destiny lay here. The strange thing, John Knox, you see, did it too, when he was a slave in the French galleys. You see, the French got hold of him and made him a prisoner, and he had to pull the oars in the French galleys. While he was rowing in the galleys one day, he looked through the porthole, and what should he see but St. Andrew's. And that was where he first preached the gospel, you see. He brushed past his destiny, just like Abraham. And Isaac did it too. And Jacob did it too. You see, Jacob on the way to Bethel. Bethel's just north of Jerusalem. Jacob must have walked past this town. And he didn't know that his destiny was there. Got that message? Hebrews 7, here it is again, you see. Actually, Melchizedek crops up all through the Bible, comes up in the 110th Psalm. Hebrews 7, for this Melchizedek, king of Salem, this was before the Jebusites got it, while the light was still shining, priest of the Most High God, in all that darkness, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. And to him Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything, the spoil. Melchizedek is first of all, by translation of his name, King of Righteousness. Melchizedek, that's what it means. Melchi means king. Zedek means righteousness. King of Righteousness. And then he is also king of Salem, Salam, Shalom, peace. So that was the name of the town, peace. That is, king of peace. He, Melchizedek, this strange character, is without father or mother or genealogy, and has neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God. You see, he was a kind of Christ. Continues a priest forever. Verse 17, you can see the words applied to Christ, and these are words from Psalm 110, for it is witnessed of him, the Christ, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And later on in verse 21, 110th Psalm is again quoted, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. Thou art a priest forever." This makes Jesus the surety of a better covenant. Got that message? Have you found your destiny yet? You found your niche in the kingdom. You found out where God wants you to be and what you ought to be doing. Or are you like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, drifting through the land, brushing past your destiny? Jerusalem. And they missed it. That's the second point. It often takes a man many years to find his destiny. And the last point is this: the capture of Jebus. The great thing about it is this: it was destroyed from the inside. Do you know the geography of Jerusalem? It's very easy. Jerusalem is built on three hills. This is the area. That's the Mount of Olives over there. That row of pews there. The Garden of Gethsemane is down here. And that aisle is the Valley of Jehoshaphat, sometimes called the Valley of Dry Bones. And it's a great gorge, and it's full of graves. Christian graves, Jewish graves, Arab graves. And the Arabs have desecrated the Jewish graves, and the Jews have desecrated the Arabs' graves, so that the whole valley is full of bones bleaching in the sun. Valley of Dry Bones down there. You climb the hill up to the Mount of Olives, and that's how Jesus traveled over the hill on Palm Sunday, down the hill, past Gethsemane, across the gorge, and into the city. Sometimes called the Kidron as well, because there's a little brook running down through it. And here you have three hills. The choir are sitting on Mount Moriah. Now that's the temple area. The Arabs have a mosque there now, the great golden dome, the Dome of the Rock, the magnificent mosque. But originally it was Mount Moriah, and you can go inside the mosque and see a great lump of rock sticking through the floor. And the tradition is that that's the rock on which Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac. Now that's holy to the Arabs as well as to the Christians and to the Jews, because we all honor Abraham and the story of Isaac. And so the rock is there, Mount Moriah. Over there on this side you have the city of David, which was originally Jebus. That's Jebus down there, quite a small part, sometimes called the Ophel Hill, O-P-H-E-L. And over here, you've got the great crag of Zion, a rough rock of Zion, with David's tomb supposed to be on top of it. And these are the three hills that Jerusalem sits on: Mount Zion, the city of David, and Mount Moriah. But just outside the wall there's a spring of water called the Spring of Gihon. And there's a tunnel running under the wall, and it comes up inside the city wall as the Pool of Siloam, by Cool Siloam's shady rill. The Gihon spring is on one side of the wall, and the Pool of Siloam is on the inside of the wall. Because if you live on a rock, you see, you've got to find water. How can you live if you're besieged? So you must find water. So King Hezekiah of Judah dug the tunnel from the Gihon spring through the rock, wonderful achievement, because engineers started at this end and engineers started at that end, and they could hear each other tapping, and that's how they met underneath the ground. It's a wonderful story. They discovered an inscription on it called the Siloam inscription. Very wonderful. And so the water goes under the wall and comes up into the city. Now that's how Joab got inside Jebus. He went up a gutter and destroyed the rivals from the inside. Now that's great strategy there. That's military strategy. That's how the Persians destroyed Babylon. They went along the canals and under the walls and under the gates of Babylon, and Babylon was destroyed from the inside. Rome was destroyed from the inside by moral corruption. The great empires have all been destroyed from the inside. Greece was destroyed from the inside by moral corruption. The Christian church is being destroyed from the inside. The real enemies of the Christian church are not the atheists, and not the communists, and not the humanists. The real enemies of the Christian church are infidels on the inside, and they are destroying the edifice. And so great empires and great institutions are destroyed from the inside. And if you want to learn to destroy the enemies of God, then you've got to do it from the inside. Like Job, you've got to get up the gutter, up the water channel. And destroy them from the inside. Why should we lament that there are no leading Christians in the trade union movement? Or do we expect? If non-Christian men go in for trade unionism, they don't just suddenly become Christians overnight. There will only be Christian leaders in the trade union movement when Christians go in for trade unionism and destroy the wrong in it. There's a lot of right in it. From the inside, why should Christians lament that there are so few Christians on education committees? If Christians don't stand for education committees, you can't expect education committees to become Christian overnight. I think Christian parents have a duty. They are morally bound to participate, for example, in teacher-parent bodies. Do you go to the teacher-parents association at your school? If you don't, you should be ashamed of yourself. Because if Christians don't go, the devil will see to it that other people go. He has plenty of disciples waiting to take over. Why should we complain that there are so few Christians in the BBC and on television and in ITV? You'll only get Christian leadership there if Christians are prepared to go to the inside of Jebus and destroy it from within. Why should Christians complain that there are so few Christians on the new councils, district councils, regional councils? You'll only get Christian leadership in industry, in the professions, in teaching, in medicine, when Christians climb up the gutter under the wall and destroy Jebus from the inside. David said, whoever destroys Jebus will be captain. And there's a thought for you. Whatever Christian has the courage and the imagination to climb up the gutter under the walls, this is the man who will be the captain of the army of God's anointed. But I ask you, which one of you is prepared to be a captain? Takes courage, takes imagination. Under the wall and up the gutter, and you destroy God's enemies from the inside. May God give us the courage and the imagination to do so.